Welcome to Project I Am with Dr. David Schloss. Grab your coffee, green tea, or smoothie. Find your favorite listening spot or put on your walking shoes. Ready? Let's go.
Welcome to Project I Am. In today's episode, I sit down with somatically orientated psychotherapist Whitney Sutherland to explore what it truly means to heal from complex trauma. Drawing from both clinical expertise and personal experience, Whitney shares how early attachment wounds shape our sense of self and how healing becomes possible through presence, curiosity, and authentic relationship. So get ready to dive right in. But before we do, here's the disclaimer.
This podcast is created for educational and inspirational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional mental health services, diagnosis, or treatment. Although Dr. Schloss is a licensed mental health professional, listening to this podcast does not create a therapeutic relationship. The content shared here is intended to support your personal development and mental wellness journey, but it should not be considered medical or psychological advice tailored to your individual situation. If you are in need of therapeutic support, please seek help from a qualified mental health provider in your area. If you are experiencing a mental health crisis, please contact a local crisis line or emergency services immediately. Views expressed by any guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily reflect views of Dr. Schloss or the views of Project I Am.
Whitney, thank you so much for being here today. I have loved the moments on our journeys where we have had opportunity to connect with each other. And every time we meet, I feel so much richer because of our time together. In our conversations, you open up doors that were previously locked that caused me to look into spaces that I wasn't even aware were there, right? And so I love that you're here today. And it's such a privilege and an honor for me. Won't you introduce yourself and tell the listeners who you are?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, David. I'm really excited to be here. So I'm Whitney Sutherland. I'm a somatically oriented psychotherapist in private practice in North Austin. And I'm passionate about healing complex and developmental trauma. I work with adults of all ages, and I'm especially committed to facilitating healing for clients who have lost connection to their aliveness, to their body, and really to their authentic sense of self.
I love that. I think, you know, you mentioned that your practice is full and that you have a wait list. I always tell everybody when they ask for a referral, always, you need to go see Whitney Sutherland. She's full and she's got a wait list, but you need to get on that wait list ASAP. So I love that. I love that you are available in our community. I feel like we've known each other for, I think, almost a decade now.
Yeah, I think we first crossed paths the 2013 or 14 at Texas State and Counselors for Social Justice.
I remember a cheese board and a bottle of wine. When we first met, how we were at Central Market, and I'd previously worked there before, and that's where our meeting was. And I was like, let's go get some cheeses. I think that's
and you introduced me to everybody at Central Market.
I was like, this is Whitney, everyone. I love that. And then we ended up working together in community mental health for some time.
Yeah, that's right. We were definitely in the thick of it together, supporting people through some really complex layers of stress.
And it just feels really special to be connecting again at this moment in time.
Me too. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on, David.
So you're a psychotherapist who focuses primarily on healing complex trauma. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got into this work in the first place?
Yeah, well, I've always been a naturally curious person from a young age, fascinated by why people do all the things they do. And just love learning about the ways that biology, psychology, spirituality all inform one another. And like a lot of us, I came into this work through my own trauma. I was trying to make sense of my childhood experiences and some of the intergenerational dynamics I grew up in, wanting to heal not just for myself, but for my kids and their future kids too. But yeah, I grew up in a home where secure attachment wasn't really available. And so from a young age, I found myself reaching outside of myself to try and get that need met. And I think there was just this big ache in my heart for safe, steady relationship. Even if I resisted it at times because it felt too painful, deep down I was really longing for it. And I think that's part of why I've always been so drawn to attachment. Even the books and movies I've loved at every age have centered on the power of safe connection to heal. It's just always spoken to something deep in me.
I love that you share that. As you said that, what it made me realize is that the parts in movies that always reduce me to tears are the parts where authentic connection happens and people feel seen. Those are the parts of movies where my kids are always like, "Dad, why are you crying? That's ridiculous." Whitney, it's so inspiring to see people have these new experiences of being in relationship where they actually begin to trust. Where, based on their previous experiences, they really don't have any reason to trust at all.
It is. Yeah, honestly, I think that's what sustains me as a human and therapist alike. I'm just in awe of how resilient we are as human beings, how even with deep wounding and all the ways we've learned to disconnect to protect our hearts, we can still find our way back to ourselves through authentic, safe relationships. And for me, getting to hold space for that process for someone to reconnect to their heart in a world that often feels so harsh and dehumanizing, it feels so sacred to me and so needed.
I agree. So you mentioned that you work with complex trauma. So for the folks that are listening who might not be familiar with the difference between complex trauma and PTSD and shock trauma, can you explain a little bit more about that? What does the C in CPTSD stand for? What does it really mean? And how does it show up differently in people's lives?
Great question. So let's start with shock trauma. Shock trauma usually comes from a single overwhelming event like a car accident or a natural disaster or an assault. And people might experience flashbacks, hypervigilance, or avoid things that remind them of the event. There's therapies like somatic experiencing, developed by Peter Levine, that are designed to help release the fight, flight, or freeze energy that can get stuck in the body so that the nervous system can return to balance. And complex trauma is different. It works with different circuitry. It develops over time, usually in relationships, and often starts in childhood, but can also happen in adulthood in situations like domestic violence or trafficking. And it's when someone has to disconnect from their own feelings, their needs, or their sense of self in order to preserve relationship, to preserve attachment. And so, what do we mean when we talk about CPTSD? There's three main areas that tend to set it apart from traditional PTSD. The first is called affect dysregulation, which means having a hard time regulating emotions and physical sensations. People might get easily overwhelmed and then shut down or sink into depression because it's exhausting to not feel steady or emotionally balanced. The second is negative self-concept. That's where someone internalizes the trauma and begins to see themselves as broken, as bad, as unworthy. Instead of recognizing the trauma as something that happened to them, they believe it defines them. And it becomes an identification, which often leads to deep patterns of shame, self-rejection, and even sabotaging good experiences because they don't believe that they deserve them. The third is impaired relationships. Since complex trauma is relational in nature, it tends to shape how people relate to others. So if someone's only known unstable or unsafe relationships, they are likely to unconsciously repeat those patterns even without realizing it. And even if there's no overt harm or abuse happening, they might learn to shut down their authenticity to avoid conflict or rejection, which then, of course, can block real intimacy and connection. So complex trauma operates on both what we call a top-down level, meaning how we think about ourselves and our identity, and a bottom-up level, how we physically disconnect or connect to our body. And that becomes a loop of energy that strengthens itself over time, shaping how we identify and see ourselves. So, whereas healing PTSD often focuses on completing that interrupted fight, flight, or freeze response held in the body and brainstem, healing complex trauma is more about working with self-concept and reconnecting with the emotions and aspects of our experiences that had to be split off because they weren't safe to feel or bring into the relationship. And there are a lot of ways to work with complex trauma, many of which can be woven together. And the therapeutic approach I've been studying for the last few years now is called the NARM model, which stands for the Neuroaffective Relational Model, created by Lawrence Heller. And I have to say, it's been transformational in ways I couldn't have expected, both in my work with clients and my own healing process.
I love that. I was just watching Lawrence Heller and one of the YouTube videos where he talks about the basic pillars of NARM and introduces it to the audience. And that was so beautiful and so informational. I sent it to all of the students and said, you need to watch this. And you've shared how impactful your learning in NARM has been. And I really hope you'll tell us more about that in just a bit. But before you do, I want to go back to something you said earlier about how people can start to identify with their trauma or those early attachment wounds. Do you find that a lot of folks come in carrying symptoms or even diagnoses that are actually, at the end of the day, just reflections of those old patterns? Kind of like they've internalized that idea that something's wrong with them.
Yeah, so some of your listeners familiar with psychodynamic theory might know the term egosyntonic, which just means certain beliefs or patterns feel so familiar we don't even question them. And that's often how those trauma identifications work too. Most people don't come to therapy saying, "I want to change how I see myself." They come in with anxiety, depression, relationship struggles, but often those symptoms are actually signals, clues pointing to deeper patterns of disconnection that live in the body and nervous system. For example, take someone who feels anxious all the time and just wants to relax. As we explore, maybe they begin to realize that they feel guilty even for wanting to relax or rest. And underneath that, there might be something like, "I'm bad if I have needs," or "I'm only good when I put others first." And those kinds of beliefs aren't something we're born with. They're internalized early, usually in response to our caregiving environments where our healthy needs and protests weren't responded to. And, children are naturally egocentric, so if something's going wrong in the family, they assume it must be their fault. They can't say, "I'm a good kid in a hard situation." So instead, they split. "I'm all bad, and my caregivers are all good." And so it could be something as simple as a depressed parent missing a child's bid for connection. And rather than seeing that as about the parent's state, the child has to think, "My desire to connect is wrong. I shouldn't want that. It's just too threatening to see the caregiver is failing them." So they come up with this brilliant life-saving strategy. If I can be better, do better, have fewer needs, then there's hope I can keep the relationship intact and I'll be okay. But the cost of that strategy is huge. It cuts us off from vital life force energy. That healthy impulse to connect or assert our needs gets turned inward as shame. And that's often where symptoms come in. Our bodies are still trying to express something important, but they're fighting against these old patterns of suppression. And so then, of course, we feel anxious or depressed because it's exhausting to keep pushing down our own aliveness.
So even the fact that a symptom is showing up, does that mean in a way that we can trust that healing is possible, or even that healing is already trying to happen through that symptom itself?
Exactly. Yeah, so hopefully as a therapist, I don't see symptoms as problems to get rid of. I see them as signals. There's often a healthy message underneath, something that's been waiting decades maybe to be heard and honored. And so instead of trying to erase the symptom, I want to get curious, what need or desire is trying to come through here? Because we're wired for connection and healing, I believe. It's not something we have to force. And in the right supportive conditions, healing unfolds naturally. So the work becomes about noticing how we might be standing in our own way of that. And that's a big part of what we explore in the NARM work that I study and practice, how we might still be unconsciously disconnecting from the very experiences we long for, like aliveness or connection. And we do that with a lot of compassion because those disconnects were necessary survival strategies as children. And, you know, they kept us safe. So things like shutting down our needs and tuning into the needs of others, giving up our right to say no or take up space or receive support. Over time, these ways of disconnecting can start to feel like our personality. And especially if we've never had relationships where we were seen and loved just as we are.
So if people have only ever known relationships that required them to leave part of themselves behind and causing them to disconnect, they will continue to do that as adults in ways that leads to symptoms and ultimately, at the end of the day, just aren't fulfilling.
Absolutely. Yeah, we carry the patterns, you know, those patterns forward long after their usefulness, and then we feel stuck and limited in our lives. And the good news is that just like a plant leans towards sunlight, humans naturally move toward healing and wholeness. We're wired for that aliveness. It's just that when we've lived through complex trauma, aliveness and authenticity have been so associated with pain or danger. So reconnecting with them can feel overwhelming or even unsafe. And healing then isn't about forcing ourselves to be better. It's about gently turning toward the parts of us we had to disconnect from in order to survive. And here's the thing, we can't numb pain without also numbing joy. And so reconnecting to our heart is a full spectrum experience. And the beauty is that when we allow ourselves to reconnect at our own pace, we begin to access something deeper, our creativity, self-acceptance, and the steady trust in ourselves. And that's the power of a therapeutic relationship rooted in authenticity, rooted in consent and non-judgment. When we're met with that kind of presence, especially from someone who understands how shame shaped our early survival, we begin to rewrite the story. We start to remember who we are beneath the adaptations.
So Whitney, if that's right, then so it's getting to know the ways we've had to disconnect and being in relationship rather than trying to get rid of the disconnection. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. So many people are already caught in cycles of self-rejection when they come in to therapy. So when we start judging the very strategies that helped us survive, we only deepen that wound. One of my mentors uses the analogy that shame is like glue. In the absence of a secure holding environment, it can hold a child's sense of self together. It becomes like a life preserver, keeping us afloat when the structure of the holding environment fails. So I don't want to take that shame away from someone who's leaned on it most of their life. The goal is more to gently help them build a new, more compassionate relationship with themselves, one that supports their healing. And part of that is recognizing the intelligence behind their survival strategies, that these weren't flaws, they were creative, adaptive responses to impossible situations.
I love the way you phrase that analogy about shame being like glue and sometimes being somebody's actual survival mechanism, the thing that's keeping them afloat, and how stripping that from them can actually be harmful. That's such a beautiful perspective, because I think initially when we think about shame, that's what we want to do, right? Is just remove the shame from them, when that might be the very thing that's keeping them together in that moment. Such a wonderful and generous perspective.
Yeah, and it's powerful to realize that, at our own pace, when we can hold permission to connect to the shame, but also to open up the possibility of realizing that those old survival strategies may still be shaping our lives, even when we don't need them anymore. And that awareness gives us choice. Not to shame those patterns, but to ask if they're still serving us. And many of these strategies hold hidden strengths. Take attunement, for example. Many of us became highly sensitive to others' needs. That can be a gift, especially as a therapist. But when it becomes from fear or self-rejection, it controls us instead of serving us. So the key is learning to use these strengths more from a place of choice and not so much from survival.
I love the way you phrase that. And what comes to mind is that choice means having awareness that there is an option in the first place. These ways that we've managed the failures we grew up in, well, I mean, they actually deserve an award back there. And I can see how you're also drawing distinction from past and present, because, like you said, often these strategies drive us until we learn to trust ourselves. Our awareness of them gives us a choice. So, in ways, you're bringing more curiosity to what's threatening about authenticity in the here and now. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, complex trauma often keeps us living in the past, even if we're not consciously aware of it. Because as adults, in most cases, there's no real external danger anymore in connecting to our authentic inner experience. But our nervous systems don't fully know that. We still anticipate rejection or threat the same way we experienced it as kids. And for a child, being rejected or shamed for who we were was life-threatening. There was nowhere else to go, so we learned to shut it down. And now, if someone doesn't respond well to our authenticity, it might still hurt, usually does hurt, but it doesn't have to threaten our entire sense of self. We can learn to feel that hurt or maybe anger, hopefully without turning it inward. And that's a huge shift. Instead of using those feelings to blame or attack ourselves the way we had to as children, we can begin to stay connected to them and over time to begin to see them as a source of important information and even wisdom. And that's the real difference. We have agency now. As kids, we didn't get to choose how we related to our experiences. But as adults, we can start to notice those old patterns, those worst case scenario fears, and be in relationship to them. Otherwise, we end up often sabotaging new possibilities before they even have a chance to show up.
That option that you just spoke about, noticing these old patterns and being in relationship with them, stepping, kind of prioritizing what's familiar, even if it makes us miserable, right? Noticing it and kind of stepping into it, stepping into the things or the feelings that we have avoided for so long, right? And when you say it like that, it sounds like stepping into the unknown a little bit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's really brave work. It's, as you know, David, because I've seen you continue to step into the unknown in courageous ways and all that you've been doing in your work. It takes guts. But the beautiful thing is we don't have to do it alone, right? I'm constantly moved by the courage I see in clients and my friends like you, as they step into the unknown and exploring new ways of being and showing up in the world. And it's so powerful to witness someone start to break free from old limiting patterns. It can feel vulnerable, of course. That's part of the deal. Because we're showing up without the armor, our familiar roles that once earned us approval. And it often brings big emotions, grief, anger, even rage sometimes, about all of the times we had to shut down just to survive. And it takes time and space to reconnect and integrate those powerful emotions and the aliveness contained in them. And that's a sacred process that deserves honoring. And in NARM, we don't rush emotional connection. There's a strong emphasis on consent, working gently within each person's capacity. And over time, that capacity tends to grow and people become more and more able to stay present with the depth of their experience.
I love the way you shared that. And it reminds me of a time when working with the therapist that you actually referred me to. And this was years and years ago. And I remember her asking me, you know, David, where do you feel that in your body? And at the time, I thought that was the most ridiculous question ever. I was like, what do you mean feel it in my body? I don't feel it anywhere. You know, I was so out of touch with my emotions and how they showed up in my body. Whereas, you know, now, if you ask me that question, I would so easily be able to point it out somatically and even sit with it, right? And so what I love about what you shared is that our capacity to be with our emotions is a window that can expand over time, right? Our ability to sit in that discomfort can grow.
Definitely. Yeah. And what's interesting is that we can actually grow our capacity by honoring our disconnection and not by forcing that connection to happen. That's been such important learning for me personally. When we try to push ourselves to feel something we're not ready to, or pressure ourselves to let go or forgive before it's organic, we're just reinforcing self-disconnection. It's like we're bypassing the very part of us that needs our presence the most. And that's why that window of capacity you mentioned is so important. It deserves to be honored. And I found that both for myself and with many clients, it's deeply healing to realize, oh, I can actually trust myself to adjust how much I turn toward or away from this emotion. And it's like we get to work with a dimmer switch instead of feeling stuck in an all or nothing, on or off kind of connection. For example, I've worked with a lot of clients who struggle with anxiety or panic and come in with this idea that not feeling equals avoidance, and that avoidance will only make things worse. So they end up overriding their own capacity, trying to feel the feeling too fast, and then they flood and their panic symptoms worsen, and it's a painful loop. And there's actually a really beautiful middle ground, a place where someone can say, this feels overwhelming right now, and I'm allowed to give myself space from it. And in doing that, they're not disconnecting. They're actually staying connected to themselves in a more attuned and self-honoring way. And maybe not connected to big emotions just yet, but connected to their own need And that's huge. And that kind of self-referencing is so healing for complex trauma. I'd much rather a client learn to trust themselves in modulating their experience than teach them to push through something just to meet some external treatment plan goal. Otherwise, I'm likely to be reenacting trauma rather than healing it. Because developmental trauma is all about the ways we've had to disconnect from our inner world to survive. So we're not going to heal that by bypassing internal connection. We can't behaviorally, intellectually, thought stop it away, or spiritually mimic that healing true connection with long-term benefits. I just don't believe it works. I believe we heal by coming back to ourselves slowly, gently, and at our own individual pace.
I love the way you shared that. It made me think of, electricity. And when I've got too many things plugged in, my system trips, right? And then there's nothing. And so I think you are naming an important piece here about pathologizing and dishonoring. Like in our field, I think pathologizing and dishonoring parts can happen more than we realize. Kind of like when we speak about avoidance. And we automatically think as of avoidance as being bad, and that people shouldn't do it, and all avoidance is bad. Like when you talk about it like this, I can see how we can actually pressure clients to use disconnect when actually them being aware of that avoidance and even using it a little bit is actually part of their healing, rather than disconnecting, having this awareness that they're avoiding and moderating how much they avoid at any one moment in time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I can feel so much aliveness and protest in me as I say this. So I'm really glad you're naming it too, that if what we're trying to heal from is objectification and disconnection from self, then seeing our clients or ourselves through a lens that suggests there's something inherently wrong with their human experience or how they've adapted to that is actually reinforcing the harm. And we see that being perpetuated by our field with diagnostic labels that we know have shameful connotations and with interventions that overlook the client's voice. And to me, this all comes back to trusting in the organic movement toward health and coherence that already exists in every person. I don't need to replace a client's inner world with my expert interpretation. What I am doing, hopefully, is holding space for them to start tuning back into their own self-listening and self-trust at their pace. And really, how can we expect clients to reconnect with their own inner wisdom if we, as practitioners, don't trust it ourselves? If we feel like we have to control their healing process or make something happen for them, that's not healing. That's echoing the same old message that their internal connection isn't okay.
This means ultimately that as therapists, we need to trust the client's own inner healing intelligence, right? That if we create a safe environment for them to be known and we give them space to show up exactly how they are, that healing and connection is going to happen. And so I don't, as a therapist, I don't have to be the expert on them or the expert on anything with regards to interventions or how I think healing should look like. But I'm actually trusting the clients and their own agency.
Right. If I see it that way, then I'm taking your agency away from you. And at the same time, I'm also likely taking way too much responsibility for your process and pressuring myself so that I'm not very truly in the relationship anymore. And people who are navigating complex trauma aren't doing so in a vacuum. They're steeped in a larger cultural context of disconnection, splitting, otherizing, and I mean we're living in pretty polarized times as a society. I think it's safe to say, and I think it's important to name that because a lot of what we pathologize in individuals, like trying to control instead of trust, is actually culturally reinforced. It's culturally egocentric in the sense that disconnection has become culturally familiar and even normalized. We've lost touch in so many ways with our emotions, our bodies, with nature and life's natural rhythms. And instead of honoring those rhythms, we often try to dominate or control them. And of course, that cultural pattern of disconnection becomes the environmental failures that we then internalize as children and individuals. And that pattern of disconnection just repeats. But that wider context is often left out when we talk about trauma as a field. So just like when a parent drops off their teenager to therapy as the identified problem, I'm sure some of us have experienced this, and they're hoping the therapist will bring healing to the broader family dynamic, I think individuals are left feeling isolated and ashamed, as if the failure is quizzically just in them. And for people who are already coping with early attachment failures through shame and self-attack, that just adds another layer. The message becomes repeated that your authentic self, your natural aliveness, is a problem. Ideally, therapy should help bring that to light, but unfortunately, that's not always what happens, especially when interventions try to replace the client's internal experience instead of helping them reconnect with it. Even if there's temporary behavioral change, it doesn't support the true healing of a new, more compassionate relationship with themselves, where that they can feel into their own trust.
Whitney, I think you said so much there that I think that is so valuable regarding just not only the larger context and the cultural piece that we live in, but also how sometimes some of our interventions try replace this trust with themselves that clients could really benefit from, right? Rather than, I think sometimes rather than encouraging them to trust themselves, we try to replace that with some rote intervention for them to use in a particular moment. That at the end of the day just adds to that disconnection rather than giving them opportunity to reconnect with themselves. And I think, like you said, about the broader cultural context and how our culture, this space that we live in at the moment, how it does actually encourage disconnection. And so as you talk, right, some of the stuff that comes up is, focusing on presence and curiosity and how that fits into healing the dissociation and splitting that's inevitably embedded in complex trauma on so many levels. Can you tell us more about how you became aware of this and so passionate about it in your own life?
I was actually an identified patient as a kid, which is probably part of why I care so deeply about this work. I remember struggling a lot in school, getting pulled into parent-teacher conferences, being told I wasn't focusing, having a hard time keeping my backpack organized and remembering my locker combination. Zoning out in class. And eventually, I was diagnosed with ADHD and prescribed a stimulant medication. At the time, I just felt this deep shame, like, why can't I keep it together like everyone else? And looking back now, with years of healing and perspective, it's so clear that I was living in a lot of dysfunction and dissociation. But no one around me really named it for what it was, and maybe didn't see it for what it was. And even when adults did try to help, it was mostly through lists of rules, consequences, a Ritalin prescription. And I mean, I had teachers, case managers, family therapists, even a few lawyers involved because of a pretty rough custody battle. But with all those well-intentioned adults around me, what I didn't have was someone who was truly with me. Someone who slowed down enough to say, "What's going on for you? How are you feeling in all this? And now I probably wouldn't have answered them if they did, because I had some great strategies developed for protecting my heart. But I think I would have felt that presence and curiosity and care as a message that my internal experience matters. But in the absence of that kind of relationship, I internalized it all. I learned pretty early that my experience was too much for others to handle, and that turned into deep, toxic shame that lived in me for years, showing up in ways I didn't even realize until much later. So I'm really grateful to say that that has gradually changed for me over time. I found myself in these incredibly healing, heart-connected relationships, especially in therapy, where someone was able to be truly present with me and meet me where I was. And that changed everything. It helped me learn how to be with myself differently. Yeah, and as I started to untangle my story, I began to see how generational all of this was. The patterns didn't start with me. They were passed down. My parents were in survival mode. Their parents probably were too. And nobody had the time or capacity to slow down and really be present with their own wounds. So that pain just got handed down. And I found that the more I've become free from personalizing and identifying with what happened, the more clearly I can see those patterns and not just see them, but stay present with and grieve them. And that's really what my work is about now, both personally and professionally, staying curious, staying present, and connected to myself. And honestly, I've come to love that relationship with myself. It's not always easy. It still brings up hard stuff, but it feels real, and it allows me to meet other people in their humanity too. And for me, that's the heart of the work.
I think I'm so aware as we continue to work with clients, so much of the work we do, the effectiveness of the work we do is dependent on our own individual growth and healing, and how there really is this parallel process that happens, as we begin to more easily reconnect with ourselves and identify coping mechanisms and all of these things that you're talking about. Just this idea that we can't really do that with a client unless we can do that with ourselves. And I think that's part of the privilege of being involved in this work with people is, the importance of me continuing on my own healing journey so that I can facilitate that and be present with that and journey with clients in a similar way. But the truth is, if I'm not prepared to do that for myself, how can I sit with other clients and do that? And that's not to shame myself, but just to stress the importance, of being intentional about our own healing. Like, it sounds like you've come a long way.
I still have a long way to go in my own growth and learning. There's always more to uncover, hopefully. But yeah, honestly, I've really come to love the learning process itself. It feels like such a rich part of being alive. And yeah, that relationship with myself, it's become my favorite relationship. It's the one that sustains me. And in my best moments, it's the foundation from which I'm able to connect to others in a real and meaningful way. So I'm still deepening into that relationship, a connection with myself all the time, and I hope I never stop. It feels less and less about arriving somewhere than it used to be, though. It feels more about trusting myself to be able to connect with myself wherever I am.
I love that. And that's such a huge piece, this idea of trusting yourself. And so, what does this look like for you when you're bringing this kind of curiosity and presence to your experience, both personally and with clients? Tell me a little bit more about what does this actually look like? Because it's great to talk about it, right? And I think as we talk about it, I get all these feelings, and there's so much of me resonates with what you're saying, but what does this actually look like?
Yeah, and I imagine it's going to look different for each person, but and it's always evolving, but lately it looks kind of like an internal conversation with myself that I'm in more and more. It looks like checking in with myself through the day. I'll ask, why am I doing what I'm doing? What's my intention here? Am I telling myself I should do this? Or does this feel right and true for me? And for me, pressure is now a big clue. It used to be so ingrained, I couldn't even recognize it. But now I can feel when I'm pressuring myself to say or do something a certain way. And that usually means I'm disconnected from something more true in myself. So I might pause and ask, am I being pulled to respond in a way that's not authentic? Am I telling myself I should know something here that I just don't know yet? Am I trying to fix or solve something for another person for that's their experience and to try to take that away from them? Am I moving away from something maybe uncomfortable inside of me instead of being with it? In the therapy world, we often call some of this awareness countertransference, what we're feeling in response to a client. And it's actually full of rich and valuable information. I know some programs teach that therapists should be a blank slate or leave their internal world at home. And now, of course, we don't want to act on everything we notice in our countertransference. But if we disconnect from our own inner experience, not only do we lose access to valuable insight, but we create a space that's not congruent. We're inviting clients to connect to themselves while we're actively disconnecting from ourselves, which in some ways makes sense because we're human too, and there's always new edges of our awareness. But ideally, we can continue to expand our awareness of those edges together. And as expected, therapy stirs up familiar dynamics. So clients will naturally bring old survival strategies with them, and we bring ours too. And so part of my job is just to stay curious about what's happening in me. Am I abandoning myself to keep things on an even keel with this client? Am I avoiding rupture that might come from being more authentic here instead of trusting and repair? Because real connection doesn't come from perfection. It comes from authentic vulnerability. And for many clients, real repair is something they've never actually experienced. A lot of the strategies we develop to cope with complex trauma are really about avoiding rupture at all costs. And the thing is, when we're always avoiding rupture, we're also missing out on true intimacy. So if we collude with a client in those objectifications and strategies, we're likely to be getting in the way of what it is they're most wanting for themselves. And when we can stay present and human, even and maybe especially when things feel messy, that can be incredibly healing. It gives us a chance to interrupt those old patterns of objectification and actually meet each other in a real human-to-human way. So that's how that some of that inquiry looks for me recently. And it's a reflective practice. I don't practice it entirely alone. I lean on supportive relationships and professional communities like the NARM community for learning and consultation so I can keep growing and showing up with more of my full self, which makes space for clients to do the same.
I love what you just said about, you know, the importance of you doing that for yourself, which then makes space for clients to do the same. It's so incredibly cool to see the interpersonal and intrapersonal connection that you're describing when you can be more in relationship with this part of you that you really didn't allow yourself to be in relationship with before. You give yourself a more authentic connection, and then you're able to hold that space for your clients as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I really believe in the ripple effect of this healing work. It begins internally, inviting the parts of ourselves that we've been rejecting back in and turning towards those. And It doesn't just stay in the therapy room. I think it moves outward, touching relationships, communities, and hopefully even the world. And I feel really strongly that the antidote to all this disconnection and splitting we see, whether inside ourselves, between people, or on larger socio-political and ecological scales, is learning to humanize, to include the quote-unquote other. It's become so clear to me that trying to create safety by shutting people out, shutting parts of ourselves out, blaming, polarizing, canceling, just keeps us stuck in fear and defensiveness. But I believe real change starts within. It starts when we begin to welcome the parts of ourselves we've rejected and invite them back into belonging. And to me, that's what real security looks like. And from that secure place, when we can appreciate our own complexity, everything, the mess and the beauty of being human, we're way less likely to project or act out on another person. And we start to see others more clearly as whole, complex, connected beings sharing in this human experience together.
When we think about the client's relationship with themselves and how they show up in our culture and community, as a whole, right now in this moment, that oftentimes people's external behavior of canceling or shutting people down or those kind of defense mechanisms are really an outward manifestation of what they're doing to themselves on the inside.
Yeah.
And, one of the things you mentioned was the importance of practicing this in community. And I think that's so valuable. Being able to operate and show up with other people that understand and can speak a similar language to you and make space for you in your disconnection and connection, it is so valuable, being seen and being known. Can you tell me a little bit more about community and the impact that has on your own journey in connection and disconnection?
Yeah, I love how you included that permission to disconnect and to connect kind of at our own pace in community. That seems really at the heart of this healing. And yeah, I really believe community support is such a missing piece for most of us. We all need our village, our tribe. I think we've become so removed from that, spaces where we can be real, share our true human experiences, and grow together without feeling like we have to hide. And given all the trauma, war, and disconnection woven into our cultural history, it makes sense that so many of us grew up having to disconnect, and are longing for that kind of authentic connection. Because it's tough being human, and hopefully we can support one another in our process and learning, rather than shame one another for being human or making mistakes. And as therapists, as you know, it can feel especially isolating. Most of us spend our days one-on-one with clients, holding so much emotionally and making constant moment-to-moment decisions. It can be a lot. So, yeah, that's why having a supportive community where we can bring our true experiences, reflect on the patterns that are showing up in our work, places we feel stuck, and get curious about our blind spots is so nourishing. And without that, we're trying to manage really complex human dynamics alone, which of course then leads to burnout, shutting down, or falling into old patterns ourselves. Actually, sometimes still think about the art project we did in Counselors for Social Justice. Can I share that story a little here?
Yeah, go for it. That was a beautiful project and a great time. Please share.
Yeah, so for folks listening who might not know, back in the day at Texas State, we had two incredible professors, Dr. John Beckenbach and Dr. Sean Patrick, who really made a lasting impact on us. They helped lead this student group called Counselors for Social Justice, which was a space where we gathered for conversations, events, and sometimes even took part in social action together. And at one point, they guided us through this really powerful experience over the course of several weekends, I think. They invited us to look back at our personal trauma histories and not just to focus on what had happened to us, but to explore the ways we had navigated those experiences. And what landed for me was that the events themselves didn't define who I was. What truly mattered was how I related to them, how I showed up in the process of becoming myself, and the brilliance of our own resilience, really. And rather than just talking about it, they invited us to express those journeys through art. And we each created pieces that represented our process of surviving and healing. And then we held an exhibit at the Museum of Human Achievement in Austin.
Yeah, that's right.
And I remember walking through that space and just being in awe. So many of my classmates, people I sat next to every week, had these heroic, deeply human stories I never knew about. And some were still right in the thick of it. It was one of the first times in my life, I think I was around 30, where I felt this group solidarity in the challenges of being human, where I felt that shared human struggle could be honored as a work of art to behold. And what a difference that makes. It really can be a work of art when we hold each other's experience in that way. Yeah, so shout out to Dr. Patrick and Dr. B, Dr. Beckenbach. Thank you. We're still carrying that work forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that exhibit so clearly. I remember the piece of art that I put together. I still have pictures of it now. And I think the thing I loved about it was that I was, in my work, in the art that I exhibited, I was honoring part of my journey rather than shaming myself for it or cutting myself off from it. I was making it really explicit and honoring it, which felt, I remember when we did that for the first time, it felt so beautiful. It really resonated with me. A number of things. One is that we had opportunity to honor our journeys in community, in this safe space, and an opportunity to be known. And I think that was so huge, such an incredibly special time. But again, this whole idea about having a village, recognizing the journey of others, being in community with other people that are on a similar or not so similar, you know, journey as I was, and making space for each other to be on journey together.
Yeah, and because it's vulnerable to really be seen and known, especially when your authenticity has maybe been rejected or just not valued growing up. And yeah, it's just been really transformational for me to feel supported and stepping into that deeper authenticity and opening my heart. I've been met with so much unexpected love, and while it's felt tender and uncertain at times, it's just been so worth it. And I notice with that support, I pressure myself far less. I feel much more in the flow of giving and receiving connection, which is worlds away from the survival mode that I used to live in.
What advice would you give to someone just starting their journey of healing and discovery, or somebody that's maybe been on a journey, but the journey that they've been on and the ways that they've been trying to heal has actually been counterproductive?
Well, to be honest, I probably wouldn't have been open to advice. So please feel free to disregard this if you want to. But if I could go back and tell my younger self, or anyone who's just starting this journey, one thing, it would be that the ways you learned to disconnect from yourself weren't your fault. And it's okay to start exactly where you are. The fact that you're even on this path means you're already connected and listening to yourself and your heart. And that's a huge strength. And you're certainly not alone in the messiness of being human, even if people make it look that way. The strategies you once used to survive those ways of disconnecting don't have to run the show forever. And over time, they can actually become powerful resources and tools that you can choose to use rather than be driven by. Healing isn't linear. It's okay to take small, steady steps. It's often two steps forward and one step back in my experience. And that's all part of the process. What matters most is staying curious and, when possible, compassionate with yourself along the way. And lastly, find communities that feel right for you, places where you want to be, where you can feel supported in your humanness, and where you can witness others growing too. Healing is so much lighter when you don't have to go it alone.
I could talk about this for hours with you. There's so much that you've touched on that makes me want to journal and think more deeply about my own journey and my own experiences. And really, honestly, at the end of the day, the way I treat myself, right? I think sometimes, it's so much easier to be curious about somebody else's experiences and their reactions to themselves than to be curious about, like, to be curious about myself, for example, and my own reactions, or to be curious about what I'm feeling at any one moment in time. So thank you for the richness of everything that you're sharing. If you could leave our listeners with one final thought, what would it be?
Yeah, I love that invitation, and I love hearing you turning with curiosity toward yourself. And yeah, it would just be that, I believe true healing happens in authentic relationships when we learn to honor the natural rhythms of connection and disconnection, when we can meet and be met, and the fact that being human means that we're both broken and whole, messy and beautiful, struggling and growing. If we can embrace the full range of our human experience with love and acceptance, then we can begin to build the kind of secure relationships we long for, not only within ourselves, but with one another and in our communities. And healing is about welcoming all parts of ourselves back into belonging.
I always tell the students, people, students, clients, that if the breach, if the pain came in through a person, right, through people, then healing will come in through people, right? We need that. We need that community. We need those safe spaces where we can be known for all the beauty, right, of who we are, but also for all the ugliness of who we can be sometimes. And creating those safe spaces for people to be known and for all of their parts, all of their humanness or their humanity to show up. And so early on, you mentioned NARM, neuroaffective relational model, and how it specifically addresses things like complex PTSD. So those are the listeners who are interested in additional training in how to heal complex trauma through NARM. Could you just touch on that a bit briefly and let us know how to connect to that information?
Yeah. And by the way, maybe I should be clear that I'm not a NARM teacher or rep or anything. I'm a student who's still very much learning. But I found the model to be deeply transformative, and I feel passionate about bringing more curiosity and heart into the work of healing complex trauma. So I'm happy to share. And really, I've only scratched the surface here today of what NARM has to offer and what's covered and practiced in the trainings. I've been studying and practicing for about 5 years now, and each time I come away from training with new insights and a deeper understanding that makes this work even more meaningful and impactful. So, if you're working with complex trauma or just curious about the NARM model, there are several ways to get involved, depending on what's right for you. In Europe, the NARM Institute, led by Larry Heller, offers several levels of trainings. And in the US, the Complex Trauma Training Center, led by NARM faculty like Brad Kammer, Marcia Black, Stephanie Klein, offers everything from public demonstrations of NARM and public webinars, so you can just, get a sense of the model, to full NARM therapist trainings and community events. One thing I really appreciate as a NARM student is learning through what they call active coaching, where you observe your own internal experience as a therapist while another student plays the client. So you get to pause, slow down, and notice where you might be disconnecting or pressuring yourself in the process. And it's just such a powerful way to learn. Oh, and another great NARM resource is the NARM podcast. It's called Transforming Trauma Podcast. I know they've had guests like Gabor Maté, Bonnie Badenoch, Richard Schwartz, Dr. Judith Herman, many others committed to healing complex trauma. So there are many different ways to engage and learn together, and the community is full of just so many wonderful, genuine, heart-centered people. So if this approach resonates with you or you're just curious, you can check out more information at complextraumatrainingcenter.com. Or if you're in Europe, you can check out narmtraining.com.
Yeah, thank you for those resources. I know a lot of people will be asking about it. And what about you, though? If people want to connect with you and know more about you, how do they do that, Whitney?
Sure. Well, I'm always open to people reaching out and connecting. My website is very simple. It's whitneysutherland.com, and my email, similar, it's whitneysutherland@gmail.com. And yeah, I'd love to hear from you.
Thank you, Whitney, so much for sharing your contact details with us. I know I mentioned you to some students the other day, and they immediately looked up your website, and I started hearing these oohs and ahs. And when I asked what they were looking at, they said your website and just how calm and soothing it was, and how they were just resonating with that vibe. So thank you so much. And thank you for being here and for sharing all of this with our listeners. And I want to personally thank you for being you and for showing up the way you do in my life. It's such a privilege to know you, and I appreciate you giving your time to do this with me today. Thanks, Whitney.
Thank you, David. I feel the same. An honor to be here with you.
The weather today will be glorious. Put on your sunglasses, sunscreen, and sun smiles. You're going to love it.